Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. When we last talked with Heather Pringle, who wrote this fascinating book, The Mummy Congress, Science Obsession and the Everlasting Dead, we didn't have time in an hour to talk about all of the various mummies that have been researched so thoroughly in her book. She went to a congress, the Mummy Congress, it's titled, a few years ago, and talked with all of the researchers and then went to most of the key spots to further interrogate them and learn about mummies. And her book is great reading and a fascinating material. So many mummies. If you think it was just Egypt or maybe just Egypt and Peru, you're wrong. Mummies, it seems, were scanning all parts of the globe and throughout the centuries, whether they were ingeniously devised or occurred by natural means in a high, dry climate. Heather joins us from her home in Victoria. Is it Victoria or Vancouver? Heather, and hello. Which one?
Vancouver.
Vancouver. And welcome back.
Oh, thanks very much, Loralee. I'm really happy to be here.
You know, one of the most fascinating finds are those Chinese red-haired mummies, dubbed the Churchin men, and women and children. Tell us the story, and the story of Victor Mayer from the University of Pennsylvania, who you interviewed extensively, who had suspected, I didn't know this, he suspected for so long that there had been early, this is 3,000 years ago, European contact there. Mm-hmm. And then those mummies were just confirmation on a long trail of mythology and samples of silk found in tombs and a long trail of clues. Tell us the story, if you would.
Oh, I'd love to. Well, the story begins about 10 years ago. Victor Mayer is a professor of Chinese literature at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was leading a group of tourist, actually. He was heading a tour group from the Smithsonian Institute, and he was leading these tourists through a small Chinese city called Urumqi, which is in northwest China, in the northwest corner of China. And on this sort of tour that he was heading up, he stopped in at the Urumqi Museum. And he had been there many times before, had seen the exhibits, but on this particular day, there was this little sign, handwritten sign, that said mummy room, and it pointed, there was an arrow pointing to the back of the museum. So this sort of intrigued Victor Mayer, so he walked to the back of the museum, and there was a curtain that was drawn over the doorway of the room, and he said, you know, he pushed back this curtain, and he felt like he was entering another world. It was very dark inside the room, but there were three cases, at least three cases of glass cases, and they contained mummies. Now, Mayer was very surprised by this. It was very dark in this room, and it was a little difficult to see, but he had a flashlight with him. And he began looking at these mummies. And what struck him immediately, the thing that really quite flabbergasted him, was that there was these mummies looked very Caucasian. In fact, one of them had ginger red hair, and the skin was a pale ivory color, although this may have been due as much to death as to anything else. But nevertheless, the mummy was fair-haired, and the mummy was also dressed in very unusual style of a very unusual style of clothes. These were a long tunic and then a pair of pants.
which you described as being very well tailored and very colorful, like something out of Dr. Seuss.
Exactly. I mean, they were kind of brilliant red colored, and the stockings the man wore were brilliant red and yellow looking. Just very strange clothing. And the thing that, that really sort of flabbergasted Victor Mare was that this particular man resembled his brother David. And so he almost instantly made this connection with this mummy. He was very curious about the mummy. The evidence from the scientists working on the mummies in China suggested that these were indeed very, very old mummies. These particular ones, I think, were around 2,000 years old. But the mummies, as Mare began to sort of talk to more researchers and explore the matter, he discovered that some of them even dated as early as 4,000 years ago. So, as I say, this was very kind of startling news to Victor Mare.
And it means that these weren't just lone wanderers who got off course.
No.
It means there was a settlement there that lasted a couple thousand years?
Exactly. That's precisely right, Lorelei. And the thing that is very interesting is I've just recently had an email from Victor Mare telling me that Chinese researchers have indeed found another 100 of these mummies just in the last few months. And this brings the total to well over 200 known mummies, and there were many. In fact, there have been so many of these mummies discovered that Chinese archaeologists have not been able to excavate them all. So, indeed, there are many, many more still in the ground in this northwest corner of China. Now,
and this is a high desert, so they were preserved naturally.
They were preserved naturally, although some of the bodies were slightly elevated, and this would have sort of increased the airflow over and under the body. So, in fact, there may have been a little bit of intentionality here.
Ah.
People knowing their climate very well, knowing how to dry things well, would have learned very, very easily and quickly how to preserve both food and the human body. You know, the discovery of these mummies was of enormous interest to Victor Mare because, as you were saying, he had long suspected that there was a very early contact between China and between the West. Historians in China, very nationalist historians in China, had suggested that China had risen in a kind of magnificent isolation, that there had not really been any sort of intense contact between East and West until the founding of the Silk Road. The Silk Road, of course, is that travel route that caravans took between Italy and between the interior of China. And so, as I say, many historians believe that it wasn't until this road was founded in about 200 BC that indeed there was, a substantial contact between East and West. Well, here Mare had found, had stumbled across, I should say, rather, these mummies that dated back as early as 4,000 years, which was 1,800 years before the founding of the Silk Road. So, of course, he went, wait a minute, what's going on here? Who are these nomads? And it really launched this really long, intensive search. He began mounting expeditions to take tissue samples of the mummies in order to find out, through DNA analysis.
Who were they related to?
Who were they related to? Were they related to any modern-day European groups? He also began doing studies, recruiting specialists to do studies on the clothing of the mummies. This clothing looked
Celtic.
Very Celtic. There were plaids. And almost almost tartan-like clothes on some of the mummies, and so again he recruited textile experts to study them, and he brought a physical anthropologist to China to try to determine whether or not the mummies had been artificially mummified. He thought that if indeed they had been artificially mummified, that the technique itself may shed clues to the origins of the mummies. So he really mounted this intensive effort. He put together a team of researchers and you know, as I say, intensively began to examine the mummies. Well, the long and short of it is, after many years of research, nearly 10 years of research now, the upshot is that the mummies now appear to have originated in Central Europe, very likely in an area that spans the south of Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia. The mummies seem to have their strongest connections with that area, particularly in terms of the style of weaving in the clothing that they were wearing. The style of weaving was unknown in Asia at the time that the mummies were alive, but in fact it was being employed in Austria at that very period in European history. So,
right where the Iceman came from.
Yes, exactly. And this was, of course, another area of interest, as it turned out, because Victor Mayer, one of the reasons why he became so passionate about the DNA analysis was that while he was contemplating this whole project, the European scientists had discovered the Iceman in Europe, and he had again made a kind of personal connection with the Iceman in Europe. This particular mummy was found in an area that was very close to the village of that Mayer's father had emigrated from. Mayer's father was of Austrian descent. So, Mayer had this instant connection again with the Iceman, thinking, well, perhaps his own relatives had been descendants of the Iceman, and he really embarked on this really kind of long, complicated project. Now, as I say, there were many problems that he encountered along the way.
Chinese officials being one major
exactly.
one.
Exactly. Chinese officials were not terribly keen on the research.
And tell us why.
Well, there are a number of reasons, but one of the most important is that Xinjiang, the province in which the mummies were found, this province is an area where there is a very restive minority group, a group that wishes to separate from the rest of China. This is a Muslim ethnic group known as the Uyghurs. And the Uyghurs, when these Caucasian-looking mummies first came to light, the Uyghurs almost immediately claimed them as their ancestors. There are indeed there are some fair-haired people and fair-skinned people among the Uyghurs, but it is generally thought that the Uyghurs did not arrive in the Xinjiang area until much, much later in Chinese history. So when the Uyghurs, heard of these Caucasian mummies, the Uyghurs immediately sort of latched onto them and claimed them as their ancestors. And this, they kind of used the mummies to support their claims to the land and to sort of bolster their separatist movement. So the Chinese,
another case of science getting caught up in politics.
Oh, yeah. And this has happened a great deal in the history of mummies, in the world's history of mummies. And so, of course, the Chinese were very worried about this minority and their separatist movement, and particularly so because Xinjiang is has a huge oil field. It is just a massive oil field that Chinese officials, are very concerned about. They do not want Xinjiang to separate under any circumstances.
And so they don't want to fuel this whole debate and let the Uyghurs, interesting spelling, U-Y-G-H-U-R, if anyone
yes.
wants to look that up, believe that they were there before any of the Chinese.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. That's exactly it. So it's been a difficult research project. At one point, the Chinese officials confiscated tissue samples that they had earlier given approval for, mummy tissue samples. And it was only because one of Mayer's Chinese colleagues smuggled three tissue samples into his pockets that he was, in fact, able to do any DNA analysis of the mummies. So it's been a terrific kind of detective story, full of lots of political ups and downs.
And twists and turns.
Exactly.
There's, even among Western researchers, there's this whole smack of imperialism and all of this, and we do have this guilt complex, do we not?
Yes.
Yeah. gee, we've just gone everywhere and invaded everywhere.
Exactly.
I guess this was our history, too.
Exactly. I mean, there are many scholars today who are very kind of worried at the idea that there may have been these European nomads who established colonies in China. They think that this kind of early colonialism, reflects poorly on Europeans, and they just are very reluctant to accept any kind of evidence of this kind of early period of European settlement in China. It just they worry that
it's
this
not politically correct.
Exactly.
You know, we just had a chat with Jim Chatters, who looked at the Kennewick Man.
Yes.
And he was telling us, too, that in his conclusion, he realizes that all the political hot potato that it's become and all, but, the point is we're all one people. We all are so deeply related. Isn't that the good news here?
Yeah, I would think so. I really would. I mean, I think that the absolute wonder of mummies is that they help us to connect with the past. They help us to connect with those who lived centuries and even indeed millennia before us. They help us realize that these people in the ancient past were just like us. That they, that they suffered diseases. That they, they lived full lives. And I think, that's really the key point here. Now
they invented, they traveled, they traded,
exactly. This is exactly it. And I think that people who want to use mummies for their own political purposes really, missed the point here. Now I should just say one other political purpose that.
Tell us about Himmler and Atlantis.
Exactly. I was just about to pick up on that one.
Because you can't twist it, one end of the spectrum or the other.
Yeah.
The dark side of this. Yeah.
This was very strange and terribly, terribly disturbing. Before the Second World War, Heinrich Himmler, who was a top official in the Third Reich, had this idea about Genghis Khan. Actually, Hitler shared his admiration. Genghis Khan being the leader of a group of nomads who lived in Central Asia, and Genghis Khan had been a great conqueror of Central Asia. He had literally practiced genocide long before the Nazi government rose to power. And indeed, this is what Hitler and his colleagues so admired in Genghis Khan, just the very ruthlessness in which Genghis Khan had seized territories and slaughtered enemies. So, as I say, Hitler and his associates were deeply impressed by Genghis Khan. But there was one problem, and that problem was that Genghis Khan, being Central Asian, was not a member of the Caucasian race. And this, of course, posed a bit of a dilemma for the Nazis because, of course, they were the supreme racists. So the way that they got around it, and this was Heinrich Himmler's idea, the way they got around it was Himmler suggests that, indeed, Genghis Khan had not been an Asian. What he had likely been was a person of German origin. Himmler suggested that what had happened was when Atlantis had sunk, the Germans who had lived on Atlantis, or the antecedents to the Germanic cultures, those people had fled, and they had ended up in Central Asia and had given rise to Genghis Khan. So the Nazis were very interested by this. There's even some suggestion that they may have been interested enough to go out and try to look for some of these bodies of these lost Germans. And, of course, scholars reading this history, historians and others reading this history, had somewhat of a cause for alarm when these Caucasian mummies in Xinjiang came to light.
And as early as the 1970s, I understand that Chinese archaeologists began finding hundreds of these mummies.
Yes, yes, that's right.
With the blonde and the red and the auburn hair there.
That's exactly right. Yes, indeed, they had.
And of course, Hitler was much earlier.
Yes, exactly.
He didn't have benefit of that.
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, there were concerns that these Caucasian mummies in Asia could be used for all kinds of weird and wonderful, not wonderful, but, you know, strange racial agendas. And so there was a great sense of concern, I think, in the scientific and scholarly community when these mummies came to light.
Gosh, you know, I just think, oh, how fascinating that people, I don't care what people, but just that people were out there trading and traveling so far back.
Yes.
Whether it's, you know, the cocaine and the hair of the mummies and a new world plant in the old world, which I know we debated last time you were on and gave alternate explanations for that, which was actually a very interesting one. Or who, I don't care who they are, but the fact that we were just out there roaming around.
Well, I think
halfway around the globe from wherever you started was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think what often happens is that we today underestimate the abilities of people in the past. And I think that there's a tendency to think that the people who went before us were rather simple, primitive people, not too swift, not really too
or hobbled by their lack of technology. Yeah,
exactly. All these kinds of images come to our minds, but really what archaeology and what anthropology, anthropological studies, I think, show us increasingly is that these people that went before us were incredibly sophisticated, maybe not in exactly the way that we are today technologically, but they were certainly well-traveled, and they knew a great deal about the world that surrounded them.
A couple of things. And also, let's not forget, why can't Europeans get out and go far distant places in the early past? The Polynesians did, the Australian Aborigines did, the Chinese certainly did. They were among the groups, and the Japanese that came here and established many of the Native American groups. So why, you know, why can't we all get out there and travel? Why does it have to be that the Europeans slap our hands? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know. I get a little tired of that sometimes.
Yes.
So, you know, we've done some good things too, you know, help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think there is a tendency to think that we're always the bad guys in the plot, but I don't believe that's always so true.
I think there's good and bad apples in all of the cartloads of apples out there.
I agree.
A couple of things. You mentioned that that Victor Mayer also found some early Chinese books that were describing tall men with green eyes and red hair resembling the fur of the rhesus monkey.
Yes.
So interesting to describe it that way. He was looking for word similarities and found many of them, early Germanic and English words for dog and goose and wheel. And they did have wheeled carts, as I recall, wheeled wooden carts, these Chrétien groups of these Caucasian mummies.
Yeah.
They were about 6 feet tall, was exceptionally tall for early people, the men at least. The samples of Chinese silk mean that the trade was going the opposite way too, because early samples of Chinese silk were found in far-flung places.
That's right. Yes.
Yep. And I have a friend, Sarah Annan, who was telling me about some Japanese Kodotama scholar that she had talked with. And he was describing early groups of Celts that were the early educators in the early, I don't know, postal system that had extensive trade routes and would carry inventions near and far. And you mentioned that as well, that these Celtic plaid coverings on these people, the fabrics on these people, and they were there were myths of how they brought writing and some key inventions to China early on. Of course, the Chinese feeling like, oh, hey, we invented the fireworks.
Exactly.
Writing and all this may not feel too good about that. But what is that story of these early Celtic groups? Because Sarah had her own story where it was preserved among this Kodotama Japanese mythology. Well, so I wanted to check out your end of this.
Well, certainly there is a great deal of tantalizing evidence that indeed these very early European nomads in China were bringing some of their inventions with them. One of the inventions seems to be writing, and one of the ways that one of the, I suppose, really intriguing aspects of how the mummies come into this is that when Mayer was examining one of the mummies that was found in Xinjiang, he noticed a symbol that was written over and over, a symbol that was tattooed over and over again on the hand of one of the women, and it was an almost S-shaped type of a symbol. And the fact that it was repeated over and over again in rows and lines on this woman's hands really indicated the importance of the symbol. And as Mayer studied it, he is an expert on the origins of writing, I should add. While he was studying it, it came to him that he had seen this symbol, of course, before. The symbol resembled a character in a very early form of Chinese writing, and it also resembled a character in a very kind of early Phoenician script, the Phoenicians being a group of people that lived in the Mediterranean.
And they were very good travelers,
yes,
traders, and navigators.
Yes, exactly. They were very good travelers. That's absolutely right. So the mummy seemed to be this kind of bridge between the very early invention of written symbols.
Because of the tattoos? That was
because
an early
tattoos,
use of
exactly,
written
because
symbol?
Of the tattoos.
Okay. They didn't find books or wooden carvings with characters
anything
else?
Nothing. No, and I think
that
we wouldn't expect to either. It's very,
crumbled away.
Yeah, it's very quite early, and the preservation, for a variety of reasons, we wouldn't really expect it, but the fact that the symbol is tattooed on this woman's hand is very suggestive. So that's one aspect.
Now, let me ask you quick, right there.
Yeah.
What are some of the other clues that these inventions were brought, and is there the thought that some of these Chinese symbols might have shown up on the Dead Sea Scrolls? What's that connection?
That one I can't really comment on very much. Certainly, Victor Mayer has written a bit of a scholarly paper on the subject of one of the symbols in the Dead Sea Scrolls resembling an early symbol in Chinese script. I can't really tell you too much about that other than he has detected a resemblance between the two. As for other evidence that really points to these European nomads bringing with them Western inventions, for example, the mummies in Xinjiang were found with small amounts of bronze. Bronze is another one of these items that Chinese historians are fond of pointing to as an example of a Chinese invention.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, when Mayer began looking at sort of the history of bronze making, the very earliest known cases of bronze making occur in the West, and again, it seems very clear now from the bronze in the Xinjiang area that these nomads were bringing with them the capability of making bronze, and may very well have brought that to their contacts among the Chinese people, and the same goes with the chariot as well. This is another invention. We have very, very early dates for it in Eurasia, along the eastern fringes of Europe, and into Asia Minor.
Mm-hmm.
Now it looks like European nomads may have brought this, the chariot, with them as well, and carried it into the heartland of China. So it does seem that these nomads were carrying with them some very important technologies, and the ones that they were able to pass on to the Chinese civilization.
Before I break, let me just ask you this, and you can answer afterwards. Then, if it was such an extensive settlement, to the point that there were at least 200, probably more, still yet to be found mummies buried in this area, they were thriving, they had wealth, they had communities that lasted a couple thousand years. What happened to them?
Mm.
How did they, what happened? And you'll talk about some of those invaders and what's the speculation has been. As we continue with Heather Pringle, her book is The Mummy Congress. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Heather Pringle. Heather, what happened to these ginger-haired, 6-foot-tall, European, Caucasian-looking mummies found in this northwest corner of China?
Well, what seems to have happened to them is that they were themselves were invaded. It seems that the Uyghurs, the people that I was referring to earlier, this Turkic-speaking Muslim group of people, immigrated into this northwestern corner of China around about the 7th century AD, I believe it was, and that the Uyghurs may have done one of two things. They may have slaughtered vast numbers of the of these European peoples, or they may have decimated them by killing them, but by also intermarrying with them. So it seems by one means or another, the European peoples who had colonized this part of China were wiped out.
Now, they had bronze, so they were able to make weapons.
Yes.
They had the wheel. Why would they not be able to mount a better defense? What did the Uyghurs have that they didn't?
Oh, good question. They may have just had a superiority of numbers. That may have been one aspect of it. The Uyghurs may have had superior military tactics. Certainly the area in which the Europeans had settled in Xinjiang, it appears to have been a rather marginal area, certainly not a Garden of Eden type place. And it may be just that it was rather difficult to eke out a living in this particular part of the world, and the inhabitants, European inhabitants, were just unable to put up much of a fight.
Makes sense. Anything else about these Caucasian mummies in China of interest?
Oh, well, there's just so much of interest. It's hard to know where to stop. But I think that the really interesting aspect of this, I think, has to do with the politics. And for a number of years now, Victor Mayer has tried to organize a traveling exhibition of the mummies. One of his greatest wishes is to bring these mummies to North America so that other people can indeed see them. And when he has broached the matter with high-ranking Chinese officials, they have not been terribly happy at the thought of sending these mummies abroad. And indeed, one extremely important Chinese official told Mayer that these mummies had absolutely nothing to say about Chinese history. And that is, I believe, a direct quote. So I think we are unlikely to see these mummies here in North America very soon.
But there have been a number of television documentaries on them.
Yes.
So at least via the television, we
have
seen them.
Exactly.
And they are fascinating looking, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
And again, I just wish politics would stay out of scientific realms.
I do too, but it seems I think we're unlikely to see that. I think that people with political agendas, of course, look for weaponry wherever they can find it, and certainly they have found much much that is of use to them in mummies. Mummies are, of course, unable to speak for themselves. They are unable to explain their own versions of history, and people have found it very easy to put placards in their hands and describe slogans coming out of their mouths. So it's very unfortunate, but it has happened repeatedly in history.
Yeah, and those mummies can tell us so much if they were allowed to be tested, to be seen. I know that Jim Chatters was just so sad that Kennewick man can't tell his story. And he said, really, he was living before there were Europeans as we knew them. So could just show us how interrelated we are if it would be allowed to speak its story.
Yeah.
Well, what tests we have?
I think there's very interesting parallels here with, of course, the situation in North America and the particular political brouhaha that is centered on Kennewick man. And, people will often think that archaeology is a very kind of apolitical field of research, but indeed it is absolutely rife with politics.
Yep. Another interesting use of mummies for political purpose was the creation of the mummy of Lenin.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, I understand the politics behind it, the need to keep this body alive and what it would serve for the Soviet Union.
Yes.
But I'm wondering, how did they do it? How do you just pull, let's create a mummy out of your hat when they did it way back when? Was that much known? And what are the various methods?
Well, indeed, there wasn't a great deal known about exactly how the Egyptians had done it. And this posed a huge problem for the Soviet leadership. Lenin died in 1923. shortly after the Russian Revolution, and it was decided by the Soviet leadership. The main voice there was Joseph Stalin to preserve Lenin, and the difficulty was that Russian science really had not come up with a good, you know, with any kind of insights into how human bodies could be preserved. The initial scheme that was presented to Stalin and the other members of the Soviet leadership was to freeze Lenin. And indeed, there were experiments that were conducted by a very good, an old friend of Lenin's, a fellow by the name of Krasnin. It was his idea to freeze his old friend like a side of beef, basically. And Krasnin did indeed embark on these experiments to freeze Lenin's body. But it became evident very early on that this would be a great problem because condensation began forming inside the glass.
I was imagining just keeping him like in a big ice cube or something.
I don't think that they tried that. I think that they were trying to. I mean, it was a difficult problem because they wanted people to be able to see Lenin. It wasn't just enough to stick him in a freezer somewhere. They wanted people to be able
to see
Lenin. Isn't
that creepy, though? I mean, can you imagine George Washington on display in some glass coffin? It's just creepy.
It is. It's very creepy.
To Madame Tussaud's wax figure place if you want to really see, you know, historical figures, I guess. But anyway.
Well, it's both creepy and fascinating. I have to say that I straddled the line between the two of them. I think I would be, you know, a bit horrified but also fascinated. I think I would probably feel both of them. But
and for sure you would go see it.
For sure I would go and see it. So so as I say, I mean, the first thought was freezing, but they scrapped that because condensation inside a glass sarcophagus would create problems. It would foster bacterial growth, and you don't want bacteria growing when you're trying to preserve a body. So what they eventually decided to do, there really weren't any of the really kind of major scientists who were willing to take this as a project. So instead, the Soviet leadership decided to give over the task of preserving Lenin to a very kind of cocky young Russian scientist, a fellow by the name of Boris Zabarsky, and turned it over to him and to his one of his colleagues who was an anatomist, and the two of them, Zabarsky and the anatomist, basically dreamed up this scheme to preserve Lenin by means of chemistry. They would immerse Lenin's body in a tank of chemicals. They were very secretive about exactly what went in this batch of chemicals, but it was said to be compounds such as old wax and glycerin and quite a number of other additives that they put into this bath. They spent about I think it was about 3 months working on Lenin, and on the great day when they had finished, the Soviet leadership brought in Lenin's wife and also Lenin's brother, and the brother said, you know, he looks better than he did the day he died, which I thought was pretty amazing. And indeed, Lenin remains preserved today in his mausoleum in Red Square. He has really, evaded the hands of time. Mm-hmm. And the people who are now responsible for his body, the scientists who continue to maintain his body in this kind of state of limbo, describe Lenin as being this unique scientific experiment.
I guess it would be. And that's the difference between the Soviets and us, for example. Yes. We would be marketing this. Hey, preserve your loved ones. Here, you know, somebody would make a multi-million dollar business out of it. They just want to keep it secret. And nobody else can be mummified here.
Well, they do. But one very amusing thing, when I went to see them, one of the scientists said to me, he said, you know, if... when you go back to North America, if there are any Texas millionaires who want to have themselves preserved or have their mistresses preserved, please tell them that we're open for business, you know, that we would more than happily
But see, we know how to market here. We would do a better marketing job than that.
Exactly. So indeed, they will entertain offers, and they will, I'm sure for a very high price, be prepared to mummify someone near and dear to you, but they won't tell you how they do it.
Oh, man. But, wax, glycerin, that sort of makes sense,
I guess.
Yes,
it does.
And speaking of freezing oneself, aren't the people involved in cryonics, isn't that just another form of mummification?
Sure it is.
Okay, with the possibility of, melting you out and springing you back to life when medical science can revive you, as if somebody would want their old body. why don't you just go get a new one, get reincarnated? But I guess if you're the ultimate materialist, you would not believe in that route.
That's right.
But it's another form of mummification. So I guess there are modern means of mummification, and they've perfected the freezing process. How do they do that? So I know you've looked into Alcor and its activities.
Yeah, I mean the companies today, Alcor being one of the companies, but there are several others. I mean, I suppose the most important aspect. I mean, it is a very complicated procedure. Again. The bodily fluids are drained from a cadaver, and chemicals are injected into the bloodstream.
Ooh, what kind of chemicals?
If
anti-freezing compounds.
That's right. I mean,
so
listeners are very interested, I strongly advise visiting the Alcor website. It's fascinating. But the most important thing that people at Alcor do is they actually immerse the bodies in liquid nitrogen. And this really slows the rate of chemical decay in the body. It basically preserves human tissue in such a way that decay takes place at just an absolutely glacial kind of pace. And so, indeed, it is a very good way of preserving tissue. But I'm afraid to say I'm very skeptical that it could indeed. That this tissue could indeed be brought back to life.
The main reason is that when the water inside the cell freezes, then you have ice, and ice expands.
Exactly, when the ice expands, it basically breaks the walls of the cells. And when you think about the billions of cells that we have in our body, this is a serious problem. How on earth would anyone repair all those cells in the body? And so. Certainly, the people who are great supporters of cryogenics have come up with schemes to or ideas about using very tiny repair mechanisms, but I think it's a very, very difficult task.
And it's an expensive proposition as well, and you've got to really hope that Alcor stays on in the future. You're paying them a small fortune.
Keep
me plugged in, please.
Absolutely. I mean, I
keep the liquid nitrogen.
I keep thinking about the Egyptians, for example. Their morticians were utterly skilled. I mean, they were probably, as good as anything that we have today in many ways. And they made mistakes all the time.
Really? But of course, they weren't trying to get you to the state where you could be revived somewhere down the road. But what sort of mistakes did the Egyptians make?
Well, they sometimes left the bodies too long, and the bodies would actually start to decay a bit. We can actually see signs of this by finding things like maggots in the brain cases.
Maybe they just took a long weekend or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or, sometimes the wrong body was put in the wrong case, or maybe an arm sort of fell off and they kind of strapped on something to take its place. And there were just a variety of mishaps that we can see today by analysis of Egyptian mummies. And so,
maybe that explains all that linen wrapping then.
That's right. Concealing the mistakes.
Ah, yeah. So Yeah. You know, the mummies being used for medicine is another interesting aspect that you cover in your book, or even some of the uses that mummies were put to, some of these thousands and thousands of Egyptian mummies. Paint, well, you describe a tube of paint that early European painters, well, at least in, what, the early 1900s, were able to buy.
Yeah,
made up of ground up mummies.
Yeah, this was an enormously profitable trade at certainly in the 19th century, but it did date back as early as medieval times, and we do have records of this trade in Egyptian mummies that stretch right into the very early years of the 20th century. What was happening was that merchants were importing cargo ships full of Egyptian mummies. These mummies were then sold in Europe to apothecaries. Apothecaries would take the Egyptian mummies, break off, you know, an arm here, a leg there kind of thing, and then, you know, break off bits of flesh and grind it in their mortars, grind it to the point that it turned into a dust. They would then use this mummy powder, and they would use it for two reasons. They would make a type of medicine, a very popular medicine in Europe right up until the 20th century.
So people actually swallow this stuff?
People would swallow this stuff as a tonic or a panacea. It's mind-boggling, but they believed that it would be a cure to everything from vertigo to, you know, various kinds of stomach maladies and so on. So it was a very popular...
You could have had some of those ground-up maggots in the brain case of some of those mummies right there in that powder.
I hate to think what could have been in there.
Now, hold it. There's some really toxic chemicals that these tissues were saturated with during the mummification process.
Yes, there were.
I mean, so how could they possibly be anything but poisonous?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be too keen to take a dose of it myself, particularly knowing what I do now. But I have to say that the chemicals that were being used to make mummies were all natural. We have to say that they were tree resins, palm oil, you know, basically various kinds of plant products.
Natron, which is a form of a salt.
Form of a salt, that's right. And even asphalt. Again, it's a hydrocarbon. It's a natural product. Now, I wouldn't advise anyone to go out and try drinking or consuming any of these things. But nevertheless, I mean,
it wouldn't kill you.
Yeah. I don't think so, but again, you know, I wouldn't really want to put it to the test.
You know, the Chinese apothecaries were grinding up strange things as well, rhinoceros bone and lion tissue and all of this. But I can understand, you know, the strength of something strong would transfer. I can see that kind of sympathetic magical thinking and its logic. However, I don't see it how you're supposed to get more life force in you from dead preserved tissue.
Well,
that's a stretch.
Well, it is a stretch, but the reason why Europeans first became so keen on this stuff was because of a scholarly mix-up, and it had to do with the translation of old Arabic medical texts. In medieval times, Arabic physicians had been very keen on bitumen, which is a type of hydrocarbon, and they had used bitumen as a kind of cure-all for a variety of ailments in their patients. And they used a very particular type of bitumen that came from a mountain in Persia. And this particular type of bitumen was known as mumia. Now, when Western scholars first began translating these Arabic medical texts, they came across the word mumia. And they really didn't have a good idea what that word meant. But they did know one particular translator did know that Egyptian mummies were covered in a form of bitumen, and these scientific studies recently have confirmed this, that indeed some mummies are covered in a type of bitumen. And in any case, this European translator, medieval European translator, thought that mumia, the word mumia in Arabic, meant you know, the skin of Egyptian mummies. He just got it a little bit mixed up. And so, you know...
But he got his bitumen there.
That's right. But instead, they start thinking it was the flesh of mummies that was really the healing ingredient in this remedy. So Western physicians started prescribing, basically the ground-up flesh of mummies. And in Europe at the time, medicine was in the Dark Ages. It was not a very... a very practiced kind of science. Some of the remedies were hideously barbaric.
Mercury was a popular potion that they were using.
Oh yeah. I mean, for example, they would try to heal the wounds of someone who had lost a limb by searing it with hot iron, by searing the stump with hot irons. Just some very hideous remedies for diseases.
Yeah.
So, given the state of European medicine at the time, I think a lot of patients thought to themselves, we need a wonder drug. We'll try anything in order to avoid some of these treatments of our physicians. And so they tried, one of the wonder drugs they tried was mummy. And it became very, very popular, particularly among the upper classes. We have accounts of the French monarch, Francis I, carrying around a packet of mummy in a pouch around his neck. Never being without
like
it.
Like garlic to ward off werewolves or something?
Well, yeah, except I think he was swallowing it. He had it there in case that he had any kind of medical complaint, and he would just take a bit and hopefully, you know, would sort himself out. So,
like snuff or something? Or
yeah, exactly. Yes, indeed.
Oh, man.
So, you know, this was a very popular kind of, cure. So that was one use that
well, look at what we do with chemotherapy drugs and
yeah,
and
exactly,
stuff.
That's right. I mean, we have great
our own barbaric practices.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. And indeed, I think there is a real parallel there because some people are so fearful of going through chemotherapy that they are indeed looking for alternatives, and so you know, the situation was very similar in. You know, in medieval times, people were very fearful of the standard medical treatments, and they were looking for something that would be
alternatives
better.
Arise.
Yeah,
and the standards aren't working. What is bitumen, and does it have any curative, you know, clean bitumen from this mountain in Persia?
Well, it does. Yes, it does. It's an antibacterial, and so it does. It is a way of fending off bacteria.
Which is why it was used in the mummies in the first place, because bacteria would decay
the
flesh.
No, there is a real logic there. Now, the thing was that that bitumen, of course, possesses this kind of antibacterial property, and Arabic physicians were using it on wounds. And indeed, here in North America, it's interesting. I've just recently come across this piece of information. But in North America, in northern Canada, there are oil sands in northern Canada, which are actually bitumen sands, to be exact. And native peoples in that area were using bitumen both to as a way of caulking the seams of their canoes, but they were also using it in medicines to treat wounds as well. So this, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, one ancient practice from medicine that has found new favor today is the use of those maggots on dead skin, you know, on eating away. And they eat away the bits of the decayed or the bad skin, and they stimulate the blood flow to the new healing skin.
Yes.
So
yeah, it's funny we are starting to see that there is some wisdom in these older cures.
Yeah.
And that indeed you know, we may have thrown the baby out with the bathwater at times when we've rejected everything that came before us.
Mm-hmm. And second use for some of the mummy tissue when they were bringing it in by the cargo load.
Yes, well, the second use was as the powder, mummy powder, would be mixed to make a type of paint pigment. And this paint pigment was actually known as mummy or Egyptian brown. And European painters became exceedingly fond of this pigment. It was said to have just flowed off the brush with a kind of sensual ease. And European painters, were in hot pursuit of this pigment. And indeed, during the French Revolution, what happened was when it was decided to open up the tombs of the French kings, this is an interesting little story, when the French revolutionaries decided to destroy the tombs and to take out the bodies of the French kings, at one point in the sort of looting, the revelers found an urn containing the hearts, the dried hearts of the kings of France. They had become sort of mummified in this very dry, climate inside the cathedral in Paris. And the revelers took these dried hearts to an apothecary. The apothecary, seeing these dried hearts, thought this was a real trove of mummified flesh. He began grinding it up into powder, and he sold it as paint pigment. And today there is a painting in the Louvre that was painted with this very regal form of mummy.
Was it red?
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. It didn't make a red pigment. It would have made the pigment would have been sort of a brownish, transparent brown kind of pigment is the best way of describing
it. Is it not bizarre to think of the kings of France and whoever took care of them, you know, embalmed them, whatever,
yes,
would take out their hearts and dry them? What was that all about?
Well, I think the idea was to make many relics out of one body. And so I think the idea was to try to...
It's like a Catholic thing.
Yes, exactly. And so, and also, it would be very important if you want to preserve a body to remove the internal organs. That's almost the first step.
But they weren't having themselves mummified, the kings of France, were they?
No, they weren't having themselves mummified. But what happened in the royal courts of Europe is that a form of mummification was practiced on royalty. And the reason for this was that when a king or a queen or a princess died, there would be a state funeral. And these state funerals would take several weeks to organize. They were very elaborate. And also dignitaries from foreign countries would travel to the funeral. It was very important during this time period to keep the body of the monarch or the royal in good shape. You didn't want to have a body, you know, sort of half decayed. That wouldn't do. And so,
nor would it smell very good.
No, it wouldn't smell very good, exactly. So European court physicians became extremely adept at mummifying the aristocracy. And indeed, there have been studies done on the bodies of the royal family of Naples in Italy. These bodies date back to the 15th and 16th centuries. And indeed, they show signs of elaborate mummification. They were eviscerated. They were rubbed with all manner of aromatic herbs and herbs possessing antibacterial properties. And the bodies were placed in, I think I have this right. It's certainly a coniferous wood. I believe it's cedar, which again possesses antibacterial properties. So everything from the herbs to the evisceration to even the type of wood used in the coffin, it was all intended to preserve the body of the monarch.
Beyond the state funeral stage?
Beyond the state. Well, I think the intention was to do it for the state funeral, but but this form of preservation was so very good, so very sophisticated that it lasted long past then.
So where would the bodies be? I mean, where did they finally end up?
The bodies were often buried in sepulchres in basilica, in Catholic basilica. So they were above ground. They were in
good airflow.
Yeah, and so they were extremely well preserved. And you know, I for example, am of the opinion that many of the kings and queens of England, for example, are very likely extremely well preserved in their tombs today.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then, of course, when people die today, one of the procedures in the funeral process, if you get the full-blown funeral, is some sort of embalming, if you can have
an
open casket.
That's right.
Right.
That's much more of a short-term kind of process, though, I must say.
But it's a step in that direction,
isn't it? It certainly is. Yes, it is. But I would say that it would be a rare body that would survive, beyond a few weeks or a few months, even after undergoing this kind of embalming.
Heather, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Lorelei.
Further elucidation of the whole weird and wonderful world of mummies. Heather's book is The Mummy Congress, Science Obsession and the Everlasting Dead. All of the latest research on mummies right there. It's a very good read. That was Heather Pringle. I'm Lorelei, and thanks for listening.
Lorelei Online. www.lauralee.com